Hey, Clint, it's Rudy Giuliani. I was very happy to see that there's going to be forensic audit of the machines. And I really wanted to talk to you about it a bit. The president wanted me to give you a call, all right? Thank you. If you give me a call back, I really appreciate it. Thank you.
It wasn't stonewalling. We were in litigation at all these points. It was getting hard to keep track of. I believe at one point there were 8 cases being litigated, and Maricopa County was finding themselves in the courtroom at all times. I wanted to make sure that I was not having conversations outside of that. Whatever needed to be said in a courtroom in front of a judge or a jury.
Isn't the public entitled to know who is paying for this, what President Phan referred to as constitutional and legislative function, this important constitutional duty? Isn't the public entitled to know who's paying for this?
It takes a lot of money to run accurate and fair elections, to have these drop boxes out, to have people servicing the drop boxes and do all the things you need to get accurate and timely results. And the legislature has certainly underfunded elections.
And with us to talk about the latest audit-related items, including audio released to the Arizona Republic revealing specific pressure from President Trump and some of his supporters, and a lot more, are Emily Ryan of Copper State Consulting. Emily, good morning.
Good morning.
And Chad Campbell of Strategies 360. Chad, good morning.
Good morning.
And after a year and a half, Chad is our first in-studio guest on the Friday Newscast. Thank you, Chad.
I feel honored, and I'm glad I remembered how to get here, basically. So thanks for having me.
Did Chad stop at Starbucks on the way?
I did, Emily, but I left it in my car. So.
Oh, okay.
Emily, I'm going to start with you. Let's go over some of this. No surprise, obviously. The Arizona Republic got this audio, and when we played that brief clip was of Rudy Giuliani talking, trying to get the supervisors to, hey, you know, we're encouraging you. Maybe you want to talk to President Trump more about this. Though it's not a surprise again, what was your reaction to hearing some of that?
I think it's stunning. And like you said, it's not a surprise, but it's stunning that officials at such a high level would react and behave this way, like they're in a 1920s mob movie. You know, a note to everyone, your secrets aren't safe. Your phone calls aren't private. This pressure to try to change election results or influence the counting of ballots in the midst of counting the ballots is just horrible. I mean, I think it's really, really bad. I think what's really good is the way that Supervisor Hickman and Supervisor Gates behaved in this. I mean, talk about men of integrity and people who were able to show some restraint. It's intoxicating to have the President of the United States trying to get a hold of you. And the fact that they were able to maintain their integrity in their positions, I would be comfortable continuing to vote for them for whatever they ran for.
Chad, did you picture the Doug Ducey when the cell phone was ringing and he just kind of ignored it as the president is calling him?
Yeah, it's kind of a similar vein, right? I think to Emily's point, you know, I really give the county board of supervisors a lot of credit here. Unlike a lot of other Republican officials who have folded and rolled over for Trump and the cult of Trump, as I like to call it, they've really kind of held their ground. And same with the county recorder. I think he's done a great job really kind of demystifying these lies that are out there and really kind of reassuring people that there was nothing illegal or inherently scandalous about this election.
Emily, does anything change with the release of these tapes? I mean, as you say, it's not surprising, although it is a bit stunning that they would do this. But on a practical level, does this actually change anything?
You know, I don't know that it changes anything. I think if we were in the midst of a current election right now, you know, timing is everything in the release of these things. I think by the time we're actually reelecting people, you know, this is going to be old news.
Chad, do you think that Democrats, for example, will try to make this a campaign issue? Can they make this a campaign issue in some way next year?
Yeah, I think so. And I do think there's some potential legal actions here. I don't know, you know, if you've seen that Secretary Hobbs has asked the Attorney General to investigate this. I think that the Department of Justice is looking at this. This was election tampering. There's no doubt about it. You know, since Trump got elected, I've said this before, but really American politics have become House of Cards. House of Cards is now a documentary, basically, unfortunately. And so I think this is an election issue, but I think it's a legal issue. I think that Giuliani, Kelly Ward, maybe the president himself, former president himself, could be investigated for potential illegal actions here. And I think they should be. And I'm glad that Secretary Hobbs and others are calling for that type of investigation.
That's an interesting point. But Emily, let me go back to some of the politics of this. And I was almost going to ask Chad, but of course we do that a lot on this program, which is let me ask the other party about what the certain party should do. But I'm ask you first. You mentioned Clint Hickman, Bill Gates. I'm not going to be too dramatic and say, are they pariahs in the Republican Party that is chaired by Kelly Ward right now? But it seems like it's more difficult for those two fairly conventional Republicans. Are they going to face a lot more pressure for doing what you said was frankly their job and being stand-up people about it?
You know, I think they could face some pressure for that. And I'm glad that they didn't care. But I do think some pressure could be coming because no matter what legal charges are filed or what comes out of this, people who are going to support Trump no matter what he does are going to look at this as a rigged system that's just persecuting him for trying to keep the election free and fair and he was robbed. You know, it's not going to change their mind. However, I would say that those people may not be in the majority by the time elections come back. You know, they may not have quite the hold on the Republican Party because when they lose their common enemy, they'll start to turn on each other, which we're already sort of seeing, and it all starts to crumble apart a little bit.
That's a really interesting point. Chad, what do you make of that in terms of, because my thinking was that in primary, certainly on the Republican side, typically the conservative activists are involved, and those are the types we're seeing really support President Trump.
Yeah, you know, I wish I was a little more optimistic about the future of the Republican Party, and I know that sounds odd for me to say that, right? But I'm not, and I say that because you really do need competing parties to have a functioning government. That's the basis of a democracy.
And I'm sorry, was that functioning government?
Yeah.
What's that again? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. It's Friday. I'm feeling optimistic. I had all that caffeine that Emily mentioned earlier. You know, unfortunately, though, I think that the base of the Republican Party is still in that cult of Trump, again, that I call it. It's not going anywhere. Trump can say anything and do anything he wants, and they believe him, despite fact after fact showing he's wrong. Trump has been conning this country now for 4 to 5 years. The grift continues. I just saw yesterday he's charging the Secret Service tens of thousands of dollars for hotel rooms at his own hotels. He's scamming the American public. He has been for a long time. And unfortunately, I think 30% of America believes him and they idolize him. And I'm not sure how we stop that from happening.
Chad, let me ask you about what you mentioned just a moment ago with Secretary of State Katie Hobbs asking the Attorney General Mark Brnovich to investigate these calls. We should also point out that is gubernatorial candidate Katie Hobbs asking U.S. Senate candidate Mark Brnovich to do that investigation. Politically, like, do you think he will do it, and what kind of political ramifications might that decision have?
You know, I think the chance of him doing that are very, very slim. Probably about the same chances of it raining in the next 30 minutes in Phoenix is my guess, Mark. Brnovich was one of the few people who came out originally strongly saying the election was fair, it was impartial, there was nothing illegal about it. And then just like everybody else running, including Matt Salmon for governor, the minute they announce they're doing something, they go bow to the altar of Trump. And we see it time after time. And that's why I'm not optimistic about the future of the Republican Party. Brnovich has changed his tune. He's now trying to sing the praises of Trump. And I highly doubt he's going to do anything of substance on this issue.
Emily, what do you think? Do you agree with Chad that it's more likely that it rains in the next half hour than Brnovich does anything on this?
Wouldn't that be nice? I actually think it would be smart of Brnovich to not touch this, let the Department of Justice handle it, and focus on common ground voter issues. Things like don't come knocking on my door for any reason to talk to me about vaccines or audits or anything else, you know, things that resonate with the bulk of the voters, because he's got to appeal to a lot of people to make it across the finish line.
So this segment is always a political lesson for me, having taken political science in college. Why is it that we could name almost every person who's ever run for office, Chad, probably excepting you, that makes a change like that? You mentioned Mark Brnovich. Emily, why is that? Why do voters accept that? Because Mark Brnovich has a record. Many people like Mark Brnovich, but then aren't they going to see that he's just flipping on this? And obviously many Democrats do that as well. Why is that okay in politics?
You know, it's going to be okay until it's not. And that's where my optimism comes from, is seeing some of the changes in voter registration. you know, as long as we have fringe people on both sides hijacking both of the parties and taking them to an extreme direction, you know, that's how you get away with it, because that's who votes. So you just start saying what they want to hear, and they're not going to vote for the person of the opposing side. But the more people we have moved to what I'm starting to call the wild card party, which is independents, the harder it is to be successful with that kind of extreme rhetoric. You're going to have to start talking about ideas and records and what you're actually going to do, because, you know, you're going to have a big, large, unpredictable group of voters that don't care about that.
Chad, that sounds optimistic.
Yeah. Again, Emily's much more optimistic than I am right now. Historically speaking, I would say this, Steve, historically speaking, candidates of both parties have done that. They traditionally go a little bit further left, a little bit further to the right to get to their base, right? Sure, but primary election maybe, and then move more to the center in the general. But again, the difference here for me and the concern I have is we're not talking about policy positions any longer amongst these candidates on the Republican side. We're talking about the underpinnings of our democracy. We're talking about the election integrity, the very foundation of our country. This is no longer about policy differences. This is about folks who are trying to literally take away the ability for elections to be operated independently and fairly in this country. It's a threat to our country, an existential threat. Like, this is a severe, severe, severe threat to our democracy. I can't overstate that. And it should be scary for all of us. And somehow we have to push back on them and stop that rhetoric as soon as we can.
So, Emily, despite the fact that we are now going on 8 months past the election, we just can't seem to stop talking about it, all of us living in the past here. I want to ask you about a court hearing this week in which the state Senate and cyber ninjas basically said that a number of documents and records related to the audit, whatever you want to call it, going on at the state fairgrounds are not subject to public records laws, that the Senate says we don't have the documents, you have what we have, and cyber ninjas saying we don't have to give it to you because we're not the government. What do you make of these arguments? There's been some discussion that this could really hamper public records going forward in a much broader sense.
You know, it really could. It feels to me like a common sense thing that if it's taxpayer money and you're handling voter ballots, that would all be public record. It feels like it should. Legally, it may be different because they're talking about communications not between the state Senate and one of these private companies, but the documents shared between two private companies. And that's always been protected and not subject to a public records request. So, you know, this may be a loophole that can be used. You know, we've never been through audits like this, but it could apply to a lot of other situations going forward.
Do you think, Emily, that you know, some folks are saying, you know, if you take this to its logical conclusion, you're essentially privatizing government, that you hire these companies to do the work of the state, and therefore any communication, any of the back and forth, any of the background becomes not public and nobody knows what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, I get that concern. You know, anytime any business does business with a government entity or jurisdiction, you know that every communication to them, every email, every text could be discoverable and open to public scrutiny. So you're careful about that. But we're talking about they're going specifically after communication between two private companies. And I just don't see where they're going to be forced to turn that over. But it's going to be really interesting to watch.
Chad, what do you think? I mean, these are private companies, as Emily points out, but on the other hand, they are doing the work with a contract of the state.
Yeah, I mean, first and foremost, this is a Senate-sanctioned effort, so this should all be transparent. There should be nothing hidden about this. And I think it's ironic that the people are sitting there saying there's some deep state operating secretly, rigging our elections on this ludicrous fantasy they live in, is now hiding their own process from the public view. And secondly, I also think there's probably nothing proprietary about this with the cyber ninjas that need to be hidden. I'm pretty sure shaking a magic eight ball as your audit technique is not something that's going to give your other competitors an advantage if your secrets are exposed. It's ludicrous. So this should be all public. This should all be transparent. But the reason it's not is because this is a joke. Let's be honest. It's a criminal act taking place. Everybody involved with this should be held accountable, either through legal means or election means. Every voter in Arizona should take everybody out of office that supported this ridiculous audit next year in November, period.
Our guests today, Emily Ryan of Copper State Consulting and Chad Campbell of Strategies 360. Emily, the legislative session wrapped up a little while ago. That doesn't seem like that long ago because it went very, very long. We're going to ask you in a little bit about the flat tax, et cetera, but just general observations. I mean, you were down there a lot. The session, again, was very long. Biggest things, biggest takeaway for you?
Gosh, you know, I think the biggest takeaway is, you know, probably our inability to plan ahead and get a budget done, even with so much money available. You know, I guess the biggest takeaway is whether we're short on cash or we have a lot of cash stacked up, we sort of take it right up to the deadline and there's just a lot to argue about. And I credit that to the close numbers. You know, you've got darn near even numbers of Democrats and Republicans, which sounds great for democracy, but it's maybe not so great for getting things done quickly because you don't have a big fat majority to run over everybody. And so it's a lot more nuanced negotiating. It takes a lot more work on behalf of the leadership to get it done. And you've got all kinds of personalities that can emerge and take control of the situation. And I think as long as our numbers are close, we're going to have long sessions like this, no matter what the financial situation is.
But Chad, clearly a one vote difference is still a one vote difference.
Yeah, and I think Emily's right. It does make things, you know, there's no margin for error, basically, if you're in the majority party. But I do think that's a good thing to have that type of competitiveness down there or that type of give and take. I think, unfortunately, though, the majority party used some very sketchy tactics, I guess I should say, or procedures to push things through at the end. This budget was unlike any budget I've ever seen in my life in terms of the amount of policy they crammed into that budget at the end to get it through. They put through policy ideas that actually failed in the regular legislative process. They put it back in there because they knew they could hijack it and force their members to vote for it. It was a shameful session, and the way they used that budget process was absolutely shameful. And I, quite frankly, I was disgusted by it. And I think that I'm hoping that this is an outlier and they do not try this again. The budget process should not be used to hijack members and force them to vote on policy issues. And that's exactly what happened this year.
So, Emily, you mentioned the tight numbers and how, you know, each, you know, Republicans couldn't afford to lose any votes. I guess I'm curious what it will take for members of both parties to have input on the budget. We haven't really seen that in a meaningful way since Janet Napolitano, a Democrat, was governor. And you would think that, you know, instead of trying to maneuver every which way to get every single Republican on board, maybe it would have been easier to get some of the Democrats on board. But Republicans seemingly didn't decide to go that way.
No, they didn't. And I think in a lot of a lot of the reason behind that is re-election. And if you've got the majority, you want to pass a Republican heavy budget if you can. You know, it's not ideal to give the Democrats wins that then they can campaign on. It's just a practical matter. But to answer your question, I think what would bring both parties to the table in a meaningful way would be split chambers. If you had the House with one party and the Senate with another, they would have to work together to produce something to send to whatever governor you had. And, you know, that's what would do it.
So, Chad, go ahead.
I was going to add one thing to that. I will take exception with one thing you said, because we actually did help negotiate a budget when I was the Democratic leader under Governor Jan Brewer when she wanted to do Medicaid restoration.
Right.
And instead of trying to force all the Republicans, I mean, continuing that hopeless endeavor, and instead of just trying to work with her caucus, instead of just giving up, she actually came to the Democrats, and a group of Republicans came to us, and we worked hand in hand not only to get the Medicaid restoration through, but to negotiate a budget that was actually bipartisan. And so it can be done. I mean, I agree with Emily. It'd be better if you had split chambers and that'd force it, but it can be done, and it's incumbent upon the governor to do that. And again, this governor didn't want to do that, so that's fine. But it can be done. I think we proved that under Jan Brewer several years ago.
Well, Chad, do you think from as somebody who has served as Democratic leader in the House, do you think that Democrats did everything they could to try to maybe force their way into the budget? Were there things that they could have done to maybe have more input there?
I don't know about that. I mean, I think it's tough to force your way into anything when they're a minority party. And I think sometimes the general public doesn't understand how this process works and how undemocratic it can be sometimes, quite frankly. And that's every state and at the federal level. That's not an Arizona specific thing, by the way. And that's not doesn't matter which party's in control. So it's tough to do that as the minority party. Mainly, though, you have to be willing and ready and provide ideas the other side and hope that they accept them, hope that they come to you, and hope that you can work with them. And I think that from what I saw, I think the Democrats did that. I just think that ultimately the Republicans wanted to go their own way.
Emily, let's talk taxes, and that's a ratings killer, so I can't believe I actually just said that. But
and I'm a communications major, okay. Let's talk taxes.
But let's talk in terms of, so we go back to Invest in Ed. Voters approved it. Obviously, many Republicans did not like that concept. We saw the governor's push for tax cuts, and obviously a high percentage of that went through. Ballot initiatives related to fighting that, do you expect to see that on the 2022 ballot? Will there be enough of a grassroots effort to make that happen?
I definitely expect to see it, and I think they'll get it on the ballot. I wonder, legitimately wonder, if education coming out of a pandemic with all the divisiveness and everything else we're dealing with, if education will be as hot of a topic as it was when 208 passed. And I think that's sort of the risk to the people looking to get something on the ballot is, you know, they thought they capitalized on that window and that momentum and the 70,000 teachers down at the Capitol. I don't know that that will still be there. And I don't know how people's pockets are going to feel after, you know, the price of cars are, you know, twice what they were and housing through the roof. And I just don't know how generous people will feel about fixing that. It's a real unknown.
Yeah. And full disclosure, I worked on Prop 208. We were part of that campaign team. And setting aside the policy for just a minute, this is another thing that I just am dumbfounded by. You know, the voters passed this 8 months ago, give or take, and the majority came down there and said, we don't care about your decision. We don't care what you wanted. We don't care what you say. We're going to do what we want. And they're going to be held accountable for that. So putting aside whether or not education is as hot a topic as it was last year, to Emily's point, because it may not be, it may be, I don't know. Voters can be mad at the Republicans. And I can also assure you, voters don't care about rich people being taxed more. They do not care. They support it. And they will vote for that again. So to Emily's point, the average person, they're not going to want to be taxed more. I agree. They don't want to pay more when they're paying more for a car, paying more for gas, whatever it may be. But they don't care if Jeff Bezos pays more. And they'll vote for it again. And this vote by the Republicans shows you how out of step they are with the vast majority of Arizonans. And it also shows you that they just don't care about the vast majority of Arizonans and their opinion.
So,
I would say to Chad that I think what will also come into play is how the story is told to the public. Because if this is a real complex, nuanced, the Republicans undid what you did, and there's a lot of math that goes into explaining it, nobody's going to have a lot of emotion for that. And it's all going to come down to, this is going to raise your taxes, or the Republicans undid the will of the voters, and how effective the campaign people are at telling the story. I think that's what's going to be interesting to see emerge.
So, Emily, you say you expect to see this on the ballot. I'm curious if you also expect to see referenda on some of the election initiatives. We saw some papers taken out this week trying to freeze some of those and have the voters weigh in, the early changes to the early voting list, things like that. Do you think those have a chance to make it on the ballot next year as well?
You know, they potentially could, and I think that's where Republicans have to be careful with some of this audit stuff and how far it goes, because the longer we keep playing that out and keeping that in the news, the more life we give to some of these referendums on election matters. So if we don't want to see those on the ballot, I think, you know, we need to wrap up the audit here pretty soon.
That's an interesting point, Chad. I wonder if, you know, if in terms of trying to get signatures to get these on the ballot, and then if they make the ballot, the campaign itself, do opponents of the laws try to tie them to the audit, whether or not there's actually a connection there?
Yeah, I mean, I think things are going to be tied to the audit regardless, and things are going to be tied to Donald Trump regardless of the situation, because there's certain members of the GOP and Donald Trump himself that won't let go of it. The potential nominee for the Secretary of State on the Republican side is Mark Fincham, who is the biggest conspiracy theorist we may have in the state at this point. He was, you know, he's been the leader of the stolen election lies that we're hearing. So this isn't going away. And again, I think there are some Republicans that want to run from it, but unfortunately, the loudest and most powerful people in their party aren't going to let them do that.
Final minute here, and Chad, you mentioned Mark Fincham, and we knew Adrian Fontes was going to run for Secretary of State. Reginald Boulding had already announced. We've got several candidates, including Michelle Ujanti-Rita and Mark Fincham and others that I can't think of at the moment. But give me an idea at this point. When you finally see this happen, let's say next fall, what are we going to see in terms of, are we going to see the left versus the right? Are we going to see more in the middle? And how difficult is this going to be as far as deciding Secretary of State?
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see. Excuse me. I think that no matter who gets those nominations on either side, the audit and that election integrity issue is going to be a big deal. And it can't not be a big deal because, again, a large group of the Republican base believes the election was stolen. And that's not going to change anytime soon. So that's going to influence this race, period.
Emily, final thoughts on that?
It's going to be the most attention we've ever had on the Secretary of State's race in the history of the state. That's my prediction, is an office no one cares about is going to be a hot topic.
Yep. In our final few seconds, final prediction. So, Chad, Suns in four?
Oh, you're killing me. Don't jinx them. Just Suns winning. I'm going to leave it at that.
Emily, Suns in four?
I say Suns in five.
Okay. Emily Ryan, Copper State Consulting. Chad Campbell, Strategies 360. Guys, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Coming up, a conversation with an etiquette expert on the do's and don'ts of marijuana manners.